Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to, well, I was going to say another edition of On the Time Lash. It's not just any edition of On the Time Lash. Mark, congratulations. This is the 50th On the Time Lash.
Happy 50th episode, Ben.
Yeah, I know we usually have a drink specifically for the episode, yeah. That we're going to be looking at. But I've just got us a bottle of bubbly to celebrate in style.
Any excuse.
And we're doing it at a respectable time.
We're
7 o'clock, it's fine.
In the morning,
yep. So let me just open this. There we go. Excelente. So there we are. Congratulations, Mark. 50,
thank you.
50 episodes in how many years?
Is it three?
Well, yes, it is.
We started in 2014, didn't we? So
yeah, there we are, episode 50. And I guess, as well as wanking each other off, metaphorically, congratulating each other.
Yeah, physically happens before the recording.
We should also say to everybody who has joined us, either from episode one, which is, let's face it, there's nobody. but everyone who's joined us, wherever you've picked up on us, if you're a frequent listener or you just dip in and out of stories you fancy listening to.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, no, thanks very much. Since it's always nice to know that people are actually listening to you.
Well, I mean, we don't. We do. You know, for instance, in the episodes we're going to be talking about this episode, Time of Angels and Flesh and Stone and Earthshock, we've actually had a fair bit of
feedback, certainly when it comes to Earthshock,
yes,
that I found surprising. But we'll come to that.
Yeah.
Because I agree with it, but I found it surprising because I thought everybody else felt another way. But maybe it's the sort of listeners that we attract.
Yes.
The more distinguished Doctor Who fan.
But that's for about, I don't know, 45 minutes, 50 minutes time. So where are we? So we're Matt Smith, we're in the middle of his first series.
We are.
His first two-parter.
Well, this was the first story that he filmed, of course,
yes,
as the Doctor.
Yeah.
So, Time of Angels, Flesh and Stone, aired on the 24th of April and the 1st of May, 2010.
Yep.
Don't know what time, it doesn't say here, but let's just assume it was around 7 o'clock. But nobody really cares, you know. Although I do remember actually this going out, because I remember, I think I was away somewhere. I was getting so many texts.
Yeah.
Going on, like from people that we just casually watched Doctor Who.
Yes.
Just being like, God, wasn't Doctor Who brilliant tonight? I said, I don't know, was it?
Yes.
Quite exciting.
Now, personal story. I watched this episode in my friend Adam's house with my then and still is girlfriend, Kat. And this episode was interrupted for us. So Adam lived on maybe the 8th or 9th floor in a tenement house in Marchmont.
Oh, nice.
And this was interrupted for us when he went over to the window to have a smoke and looked out and he went, Ben, you've got to come and take a look at this. And we look over and we can see down into maybe like the fourth, like across the road, the fourth floor. Mm-hmm. And there was a guy vigorously masturbating. Sitting at his desk, which he'd positioned next to the window, and he was properly going at it. Roundabout with the Doctor is when the Doctor suddenly realises that the statue should have two heads.
One man was ripping the head off something else entirely.
one climax was disturbed by watching another climax. So this is. I remember this.
Fantastic.
I remember this very well. This situation. He was properly battering at it. It was.
So Ben.
Yes. Okay.
Where do you think the Time of Angels, Flesh and Stone, comes in the first 5 decades, Paul?
First 5 decades, Paul. Right. So Matt Smith, I think we've already established, is the 11th hour is the highest placed Matt Smith, isn't it?
Yes, at number 17.
17. Is this like 54?
Oh, one out,
is it?
One out. It's 53.
Okay.
Between 52, The Impossible Planet and the Satan Pit, and 54, The Time Warrior.
Okay.
So there we go.
So how did I remember that? Well, both of those Time Warrior.
We've done, Planet, so you probably done, yeah, had them in your head. Okay. Yeah.
He's gonna have to settle at some point.
Yeah.
We remember.
By which point I'll release a new poll.
Yeah.
So yeah, where to begin?
Where to begin? Where to begin?
So, I forgot to mention also, it directed by Adam Smith, mm-hmm, written by Stephen Moffat.
Well, you, maybe this is a place to begin. So we've already had a little mini interview with Adam
Smith.
I did,
yeah. Well, I've actually had two since
I
caught up with him again during the London Film Festival to talk about his new film. This was the first story they filmed.
Yes.
So Matt Smith and Karen Gillan were still quite fresh.
Yeah.
And I think he sort of talked a little bit about how she was still trying to kind of get to grips with the sort of acting that he certainly wanted as a director, mm-hmm, in the project. I don't think any of that shows on screen. I think it's so assured from both of them.
Yeah.
Like, you really feel like this is like four episodes in, if not more, actually. Yeah. They're just so, like, immediately comfortable with each other.
Yeah. Comfortable with each other. I mean, comfortable with each other, and no sign of intimidation from Alex Kingston.
Yeah, who is the kind of familiar face for the audience to kind of latch onto.
But more than that, has already, how many was she, like 7 years in ER?
Well, yes, of course, yes.
So she's had quite the career prior to this point. And they managed to fill the screen as much as she does.
The three of them are fantastic together.
Yeah. But it is interesting that it is the first episode, because it does seem, more than the 11th hour, it does seem like an hour and a half audition tape for Matt Smith. Because he properly is all over the map. You know, in terms of the performance.
Yes, yes. But it's controlled. I know what you mean. It's like like everything you would expect a doctor to do.
Yeah.
He kind of does.
No, I mean, like, from Stephen Moffat's point of view, like, he's written a charming doctor bit, mm-hmm, and be a funny doctor bit, and be an angry doctor bit, and be a vengeful doctor bit, and be excited. Like, everything is in there.
Yeah, it is.
Which makes me think as well, was it the first one he wrote as well? I don't know.
I don't know the answer to that. You kind of feel, don't you, that sometimes, as much as it's sometimes maybe easier for an actor to throw themselves into a role and kind of play, oh, I'm going to play me learning how to play the role.
Yeah.
Which Doctor Who has that unique thing.
Yeah.
It's like, it's not just an actor playing a role.
Yeah.
For the first time. It's an actor playing a character that is getting to grips with his whole being.
Yeah.
Which is not a lot of actors can pull that off, and thankfully we've had 12.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, there is quite a precedent. I mean, McCoy's first story wasn't Time and Narani, am I right in thinking that? Or maybe not.
But no, I think it was.
But certainly, Peter Davison's first story was not Castrovalva.
No, they filmed Four to Doomsday first.
Yeah.
I think they filmed The Twin Dilemma first, certainly, because that was just the end of that series.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, okay, so when I say precedent, forget that. Like, one
just
time
Davison,
it happened.
Just Davison, yeah.
One time it happened.
But why do I... But no, because, like, when you said that, I was like, well, yeah, absolutely. Well, I suppose the nature of a precedent is that it has happened before, so you're absolutely right to say
yeah,
that.
But I built precedent up like it was earth-shattering.
Eccleston, they didn't film Rose first, they filmed Aliens of London,
Aliens
World
of
War
London.
III.
No, didn't they do Aliens of London, Rose, and World War III all at the same time? It was the same plot.
Perhaps.
So they
perhaps
were literally dancing between various episodes.
That's maybe true.
That's
and I don't think they did New York, well, they, no, they would have done because, well, fuck,
forget it. Talking out our asses. Talking out our asses. Anyway, So what is it? It's Doctor and Amy.
Mm-hmm.
We've got River Song returning.
Well, we've got one of the most exciting pre-title sequences I think there's ever been in Doctor Who.
I think it's the best.
And it's one of those things that Stephen Moffat, as a writer, just does so well.
Yeah.
Like, I love his kind of sense of scale.
Yeah.
Like, Russell T has many things that are great about his writing. But, like, you always kind of feel with his, like, his season finale kind of openers, because this feels like a big season finale, like something huge is going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many different things happening in different time periods and all that kind of thing. Whereas Russell T always kind of keeps it quite, like, lots of things are happening, but it's all in the same world.
Yes, yeah.
So that somehow kind of makes it feel smaller.
Yeah.
Whereas this is like this.
It's all very linear.
Yeah. Whereas this is all over the shop. Like, River Song's on a cruise liner, and she sends a box, which the Doctor finds in the museum sort of thousands of years later, which then brings him back to the spaceship to pick her up.
It's so it's so exciting. It is so exciting.
Yeah.
It's so well executed. It's great. I mean, it's the best one. I mean, how can you deconstruct the best? It's just, it's my personal opinion, it is the best opening title sequence we've had in Doctor Who. It does carry that on. It is certainly one of the most atmospheric and genuinely chilling Doctor Who's.
Yeah.
Both episodes.
Well, I mean, a lot of people have said, actually, well, we should maybe do some listener
some
feedback.
Good feedback on
because
Facebook.
It ties into what I was going to say about this, both the positives and the negatives. So, Paul McAvoy on our Facebook page.
Hello, Paul.
Hello, Paul. Time of Angels is excellent. The aliens to Blink's Alien. Now, I want to come back to that
yes,
in a bit.
Yeah.
River's great. The scares and set pieces are incredible, right up into an ending that doesn't quite make sense, which, again, I'm sure we'll come to in a second.
Yeah.
Then we've got Jeff Waddle, and I think it's interesting,
the
actually.
The
ever-reliable Jeff Waddle. Time of Angels is always going to be his favourite Matt Smith story.
Yes.
Ironic, because it's the first one that he filmed, so it's like he never got better for Jeff.
Yeah.
Creepy, a runabout, funny, and a doctor who can flip between all aspects of his personality at ease, as you've already pointed out. Later on, I mean, obviously this is Jeff's own opinion, the views here are not necessarily shared by On the Timeless, but Matt became a kind of parody of his nuances, but they're genuine here, as good as new Doctor Who gets.
I get what he means. I get what he means. There's a degree of honesty in the. What do I sound like inside the actor's studio? There's a degree of honesty in the performance. There's a freshness and I think an honesty in the performance that Matt Smith gives. And as he gets on, yes, possibly, but that probably stems from the writing, that there's a slight kind of play up to that.
I think
affectation.
It's that. I think you're
the constant pissing about with fezzes. Sorry, sorry if that's an unpopular thought, but you know.
Yeah, there is that. But I think you're right. I think it's very much a case of that. It's what this is Stephen Moffat's written the Doctor as he kind of sees the Doctor as a character.
Yeah.
And then Matt Smith's inflected all his various.
Yeah.
Personality traits and what he wants to bring to the character, so then we get that. But then everybody that comes after that as a writer is writing Matt Smith as the Doctor, and sometimes that's great and sometimes that works, and then other times, as Jeff points out, it can seem like a parody.
Yeah,
but that's not so much Matt's performance. I think that's just people writing what Matt Smith's Doctor would do. It's that, you know, it's you get that a lot, I think, in sort of spin-off fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you'll read, like, a Tom Baker book and he'll be, like, fanning around. I remember, like, the New Adventures, you know, the Seventh Doctor would always be turning on his umbrella or, like, spinning his umbrella. Or, you know, that kind of thing.
Well,
it's just
I mean, having a think about that just now, I think when we've done this podcast and the episodes of David Tennant's run, that we found him to be the most irritating, actually have not been written by Russell T. It's been other writers playing up the Cockney white boy. So that's some great Jeff work going on there. Yeah, nailed it, mate.
And I think Paul's point, which I want to bring it back to your comment about atmosphere, about it being the aliens.
Yeah.
To Blink's Alien.
Well,
now,
yes.
I have always not really liked Aliens, which I know is an unpopular opinion, and I'm sure there'll be many more unpopular opinions as we carry on this episode.
Well, you should see what it says about you.
But for me, Alien is just a fucking masterpiece. It's possibly the best. I mean, and I love Blade Runner, but I think it's the best Ridley Scott gets as a director, because it's such an atmospheric film. It's such a creepy film.
Yeah.
And it shoots that creature so well by not really displaying it properly. You know, it's that Jaws thing of, like, you never fully see the creature.
Yeah.
And that really adds to the mystery and that adds to the scares. Aliens. There's some interesting stuff at the start about Ripley's been away for a long time and all that kind of character stuff's quite interesting. But then you stick her with a bunch of unlikable marines.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's, like, no atmosphere whatsoever. It's just like, oh, there's shitloads of aliens now. And then it just becomes, like, a big, loud action film. So I think, on the surface, I think Time of Angels is very much that.
Yeah.
It is, you know, it's the Doctor and River and Amy with a group of Marines, and there's loads of weeping angels.
Yeah.
But I think that is where the comparisons end, because I do think this is it's doing different things, and I'm sure somebody who loves Aliens will be like, well, it's the same about Aliens.
Mm-hmm.
But it's doing different things to Blink, and it's taking the weeping angels off in a different direction. And I do have some sort of reluctance towards the accepting the, sort of like the added powers that they have.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they can be stored in people's eyes or they, you know, that kind of thing.
Because he read an ancient book.
Yeah. But
that was proper Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade shit there, that was.
But I think I like the idea of they're so starved of power.
So does that mean then that Sally Sparrow,
what's
his name, Nightingale, every time that they quite obviously
looked
in the eye.
Yeah, it's nonsense. Like, I like the idea that the reason that they're not zapping people back in time
yeah.
is that they're sort of like they're starving. They don't have to, they're not at the full strength, but yeah. so they just resort to this sort of animalistic breaking of necks and like
sure. But I thought the whole point of the angels got power and energy and life
yes.
from zapping people back in time. I thought that was the
yeah,
whole thing.
That's a good point of view.
So. Why are they? So they're deliberately stumping themselves then. I mean, no, maybe they're just completely, you know.
But like, then, you know, if you.
I mean, how many times have we seen, you know, Tomb of the Cybermen, Attack of the Cybermen? Cybermen just break out of their tomb and go absolutely mental. There's no logic or anything yeah. like that. So maybe that is what we're looking at. But they see, you know, particularly Angel Bob seems pretty switched on and they're doing it out of.
Yeah.
Out of sheer malice.
Yeah, maybe even that, which is, I mean, you know, a lot of it is Stephen Moffat, and the fact we've got River Song back, it really harks back to Silence in the Library.
Yeah.
Which, fine, it's okay to do, because what's around it, and I think the script is fantastic. Yeah. Dialogue
yeah.
is just stupendous. But you do feel already that he kind of is starting to lean, just a little bit, not too much, but starting to lean on, like, kind of, old favourites in terms of like
yeah.
what he's doing.
Well, watching it back again, and I actually felt this when I first saw it, there's a lot about it which is excellent.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot about it which is deeply unsatisfying because there's a lot of mythology and setup
yes.
woven into this thing. Like fast forwarding the comment about the illogical ending. It's not just a bit odd. It's a really angry making ending. It's a complete
yeah.
Deus Ex Machina.
Oh yeah yeah yeah.
A complete like how do we get rid of these? We literally I've created
yeah.
An enemy that I can't get rid of.
Yeah.
So what do? Ooh, spooky yeah. crack in the wall.
I'll put a crack in because then we'll yeah. make it a thing that yeah. can suck people into.
And,
yeah.
And then, ooh, we'll set it up for the rest of the series so yeah. I don't have to bother my arse thinking about what it is now. Ooh, it's just
yeah.
weird.
Yeah, there's a bit, there is.
I'll that. Buy myself another couple of months before I have to explain.
Yeah. yeah, there is a bit of a suspicion about that.
Yeah. And yeah, you're right, there is the beginning, and I feel like I'm turning this to come with me, Mark. It's awful. Like, I know what you mean. There's something that irks me about River showing up now.
But I like River.
Sure. We're on record as saying we like
her. I'm a River Song convert. I was getting a bit, and I think this is what you maybe about to say. River becomes kind of a caricature as it goes on.
Yeah,
and where I've really enjoyed her. Recently is on Big Finish
mm-hmm.
because I think certainly Matt Fitton as a writer really kind of captures the character quite well
yeah.
and it's been kind of fun to kind of listen to River Song and her own adventures mm-hmm. or River Song alongside Paul McGann
yeah
is quite a good thing. So actually to go back and watch this
yeah.
I was quite happy to see her. I was like, oh hey, it's River yeah. Song. How exciting. And it is, she does get a proper kind of,
she becomes too much of a bloody know-all. I think that's the problem.
Yeah
had.
It's this kind of not smugness, but
yeah, it's yeah. Okay. Anyway, right. I don't quite know what I mean there, which is exactly where the listeners tune in for some vague mental befuddlement.
I really like On the Time Lapse. They talk about Doctor Who. Oh, great. Do they have any particular insights?
Nah.
Sometimes, or mainly, they just kind of just get a bit pissed and just ramble on. And occasionally, there's really this nugget of a wonderful observation.
Yeah.
And then they'll just abandon it and go off in a different direction.
Yeah.
It's a bit like Stephen Moffat's Doctor Who, if you. Yeah.
Boiling it down is that sometimes it's just watching it on its own. It's an unsatisfying solitary watch. Because there's so...
This is the first time I think I've watched it since it was on. Genuinely, yeah. I don't remember ever watching it again.
Yeah.
And it was quite nice.
Yeah, it was.
A lot I took from it.
But I think having watched it originally, and then again I'm taking this away from watching it for this, is that all of the big answers about this do not appear at the end of this two-parter.
Yeah.
So what you have, essentially, is an hour and a half of atmosphere. And I don't necessarily know if that's enough to yeah. sustain it.
No, I think that's a fair point.
As a thing in and of itself.
Because I think when you make the resolution,
yeah.
the tie-in to the rest of the series,
yeah.
then you kind of just think, well, what was the other hour and 28 minutes for?
Yeah. Well, you know, and we've talked about this, particularly with Silence in the Library, that the big idea that Moffat said about bringing to, that he wanted to bring to Doctor Who, is that when you hit a two-parter, the climax has got to, the pickup in the next, the cliffhanger, has got to move the story along quite substantially.
Yeah, you've got to basically open in somewhere completely different. Yeah, yeah. Do something. Yeah.
However, I feel like he's slightly regressed, because you pick up in Flesh and Stone, and the same thing is still happening to them.
Yeah,
it's, you know, like they're upside down now.
Yeah,
but then the climax keeps being resolved for 45 minutes because they're constantly still picking that up. They're constantly being hunted by
angels.
It's a
Base Under Siege story, essentially.
Yeah.
This one. Which is fine. There's a lot of great Base Under Siege stories, but the very nature of that means that you're locked in a place with monsters that want to kill you.
Yeah.
So you'll go into, you'll go in somewhere, you'll be safe for a little bit. Yeah. But, oh wait, no, they found a way in.
But you do suddenly, with the second episode of Flesh and Soul, you do feel it quite tiresome. That the 45 minutes, and that is, I mean, that's the second part, I think, does let it down. Is that they've built up this wonderful atmosphere, these really great characters, and then it stretches out maybe the last 15 minutes of an hour-long episode to another 45 minutes.
Yeah,
and then tacks on this bizarre cop-out ending.
Yeah, and it is a
when it just sucks away the angels and everybody else who matters.
Well,
Well,
the thing is, because I mean, watching it again, and the Doctor's like, you know, oh well, you know, I need to feed at a complicated time space event like me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, well, yeah, but you've got like hundreds of weeping angels there, mate. Yeah. Like, you, why has this not occurred to you?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if I felt that at the time watching it. But it seems so, like, the stakes aren't really that high.
It seems, the ending all seemed a bit on the hoof.
Yeah.
There's a couple of mental leaps of deduction that you just thought, how have you done? How? You, and then, again, I mean, I think that was the other thing that occurred to me, and certainly occurs to me now, is that while the Weeping Angels have new powers suddenly, the crack in the wall has fundamentally changed. I thought it was supposed to be
a bridge between universes or something.
I thought it was a gap for an alien prison where things could come in and out.
Yeah.
Now it's a weird explosion.
Now it's a hole in time that can, you know, rewrite history. It's a big,
So that feels deeply, deeply unsatisfying.
Yes.
But if we look at it just as an atmosphere piece, I watched it late at night, lights were off, full, you know, two parts in one go, as an atmospheric piece, as something chilling, as set pieces and direction and writing, it was great. More than just that, it was also very funny.
Yeah, it is very funny.
Verger, have you got those explosives yet? It's a great line.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of, and actually, I had no, like, the Headless Monks are mentioned in this.
Yes, yeah.
It's like, you know, I was like, oh, yeah. But yeah, I mean, I like the idea of a militarized church.
Yeah.
In the future.
Yeah, you can see why that happens.
It's such a Robert Holmes thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, to kind of just like, oh yeah, well, the church have to move on.
Yeah.
And then your mind just opens up to this, like, well, what the hell is that? Because some people, I think writing, well, how people appreciate screenwriting now, I think it's changed. I don't know what's changed it, but now a lot of the time, you know, somebody will criticise something for, like, opening up an idea and not dealing with it or something. I said, well, no, but that's just building a world.
Yeah.
That's okay. And I think Stephen Moffat sometimes gets a lot of criticism for that, when actually what he's doing is that great Robert Holmes thing, or that great Russell T Davies thing, of being able to just, like, conjure up an image with just a few lines of dialogue.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, this, because essentially they are just an army, like, as the story goes on.
Well, what does River say? River said, have we done the Bone Meadows yet?
Yeah.
What an evocative, two words, Bone Meadows.
Yeah.
What an evocative picture.
Uh-huh.
What must that look like? Well, I'm going to enjoy it.
You don't need to see it.
Yeah. But more than that, I mean, they cast good people.
Ian Glen is wonderful.
Yeah, he is, absolutely is. More than that, though, I mean, I don't have the names in front of me, but particularly the guy who plays Bob.
Yes, yeah, he's very good.
you know, like it's a great cast. But we've talked about this before. Is there ever a terrible cast? Are there ever terrible performances in modern Doctor Who now?
Coming up later, Earthshock.
That's what I'm talking about. Modern Doctor Who. Everybody's terrible in Earthshock, except Beryl Reed.
Fuck off.
No, we're going to have a chat about that. We're going to have a definite chat about that. She's exactly what she needs to be. Very possibly the best performance. Maybe not the best performance, sorry. The best scene. Is Matt Smith and Ian Glover, the angel going to break his neck.
It's beautiful. I kind of have my issues with how the Weeping Angels are presented in this story, but I think that gets across just the real horrifying idea behind the Weeping Angels, is that they delay your death.
Yeah.
So even though they're not going to zap him back in time, they've got him by the neck, but they can't snap his neck until the doctor looks away.
Yeah.
That's a horrible fucking concept.
Yeah.
Because, you know, eventually he has to... He does have to look away. He does have to walk away.
Eventually, if he commits himself to keep staring, he's going to fall asleep or he's going to blink. Yeah. Something's going to happen.
I mean, you know, that's life, I guess. It's kind of a metaphor for how we all live our lives, is that we know it's going to come at some point.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It's constantly got a stranglehold around us.
It's a really horrible, metaphysical horror.
Yeah. It's a great scene. It's a great scene. And...
I think that was one of those nuggets of good observation within drunken, you know, shenanigans that we talked about earlier.
Yeah, every now and again, that was a good pinpoint. I really like the fact that we've had obviously the Beast Below, the space whale.
Mm.
But I think it's the first time that the 11th Doctor has been directly faced with the choice of a human death.
Yeah, I guess
he's saved the, on such a small personal level, he saved the world.
Yeah, because nobody really dies in the 11th Hour, do they?
No.
And then Power of the Daleks.
No, Victor.
I mean, it is Power of the Daleks, but Victor.
He's too busy up with the Dalek spaceship. You know, it's Amy that.
And he's saving the whole planet rather than
It's Amy that takes care of the human Bracewell element. Yeah. You know, this is the first time. As that doctor, I think he's had that defining moment that I suppose you get after a regeneration, where that's the moment you choose to continue being the doctor. If the ethos of the character,
is to be
believed
and
earned, you know.
Yeah, it's definitely my favourite scene. So I'm very glad that you appreciate it in the same way as me. But I shouldn't be surprised 50 episodes in, I suppose, should I?
There's a reason we keep doing this.
Yeah, that's true.
There's a reason that it hasn't, like a lot of other podcasts, just fallen away into nothing. Yeah, okay. All right. Well, okay. I mean, that's a lot of... we've danced around basically the whole production already. I mean, is that it? Have we done it all? I don't think so. Angel Bob is chilling.
Yes.
That is...
We have no need for comfy chairs.
Yeah.
It is a chilling idea. Because it's not like the... What was her name?
Miss Evangelista.
Thank you.
Yes.
It's not like that, where it's somebody essentially leaving their last will and testament sort of thing.
Yeah.
This is something that has murdered somebody.
Yeah.
And is now speaking through them to freak everybody out.
Yeah.
Again, it's a really horrible... concept.
Yeah, I mean, familiar though. You know, the fact that I was able to say Miss Evangelista, shows that there's a slight repetition.
There is.
With Moffat, but also, Children of Earth, Torchwood. That's essentially what happened.
Oh, of course, yes. Yeah, it's so long since I watched it, but yes, you're right.
So. Did it diminish its power? I don't know. I think watching it and I think it was the second time. I don't think I've watched it since it was on.
Mm-hmm.
I think watching it again, I was far more impressed by it than I was at the time. But as I said, when halfway through the first episode, you're getting called over to, you know, like a street time wank show. You know.
Wasn't that on The Fringe this year?
So maybe my initial thoughts on first broadcast are not necessarily to be listened to. Because I had a lot to process that day.
I like the kind of shenanigans with the gravity.
Yes, yeah.
That's quite a nice inventive kind of get out for a cliffhanger. It's like, we're down here, they're down here with us. How are we going to... Well, we just need to get up there. How are we going to do that?
So obviously the... two things I want to bring up here is first, this is on first broadcast, the second time that Graham Norton has...
Although, was that not only in England?
No, I remember it in Scotland.
I
certainly remember.
Because
there was a little animated Graham Norton appeared on screen as the Doctor was giving his final speech and holding the guns.
Right, because I think I watched it on the because I was out.
Yeah.
And everybody was telling me how fucking great it was.
Yeah.
I watched on the iPlayer, by which point, obviously, it was not on the iPlayer version.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, that's just the programme.
It was that year where all BBC personalities had little cartoon eye dents.
Sure.
I don't know. So, yes, a grim... However, I remember at the time, one of the big things that fans were annoyed at was the suggestion of the noise of the TARDIS.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so River makes that joke.
Yeah.
And then everyone goes, well, why does the Monk's TARDIS and the Master's TARDIS and the Rani's TARDIS all sound like that then? Have they got the brakes on? I remember...
True fan voice, Ben. Well done.
I remember as what is meant as a joke caused a lot of shit. People seemed really angry at it.
But isn't even
in the highest echelons. I remember somebody was quite angry about this in Doctor Who magazine.
Oh, okay.
I can't remember who it was. But I love that element.
I love the way I don't know what it was I love about that sentence. But just you going, I remember that somebody was quite annoyed about it in the pages of Doctor Who magazine. It reached that high, I tell you.
Yeah, well, that was the moment when I think the Doctor Who magazine was less policed than it is now.
No, I would argue that Doctor Who magazine
was more
policed in the RTD era.
No.
Because I think Stephen Moffat doesn't really give as much of a shit.
Well, you know, very possibly, but I don't understand why people don't take that for the joke that it is.
Well, I know.
Which is that obviously the sound of the TARDIS is like that, but River is playing on the Doctor's uncertainty
that he
has about his own machine, going...
Which has been well established in the programme's 50 years.
Yeah, so she jokes you leave the brakes on, and for a split minute goes, do I? Is that why I said that?
Yes, yeah.
Because I stole this thing, and I don't... Even now, I don't really understand it. Oh, God. Nah, she's kidding. She's of course it's there. It's meant as a kind of double bluff joke.
Why is it that the bowler hat wearing Time Lord makes the noise when he appears?
It's because she's having she's testing the Doctor and having a banter double bluff joke with him.
Yeah, which is their relationship as we will come to understand it.
And it's amazing that the relationship does seem so fully formed.
Yeah.
I think some of the best moments in this are when the Doctor does get angry. Right, so right at the start, he's really reluctant to help River.
Yeah, he wants to leave.
Because he doesn't want to trust himself getting into whatever romance leads him to reveal his name.
Yeah.
And doesn't want to have to face the fact that he knows something terrible about her and he's going to have to carry about in this thing. And then at the end, when they're in the control room, where he's like yelling at her, basically berating her for getting him involved in this whole thing, you know.
But again, do you know what? I think that is the thing. I think maybe I said this when we talked about the Husbands of River song. Was that the thing I love about the Doctor and River and that whole thing of the, you know, he knows she's going to die.
Yeah.
I said, well, don't we all? Like, don't we all know that relationships will end or that even if we did, even if we were lucky and we make it to, at the end of the day, one of us has got to go.
Yeah.
And I think... I don't know, I think that kind of, it plays on that idea that, you know, like the Doctor's just avoiding life, really. He's just avoiding that kind of, these very human elements.
Yeah.
Because that is his character. He just runs off and he has adventures and he doesn't stop long enough to kind of...
Yeah, well, doesn't River say that, basically?
I think, Manhattan, later on,
don't ever let him see the pain or the mess that he causes.
Yeah.
Because it basically revulses him, you know. So I get that.
But yeah, they were great, really great together. Yeah. And like, again, you know, it's his first episode, but you do get the sense that not necessarily this Doctor and that River have been bumping into each other here and then, but the Doctor and River have certainly been.
Yeah.
You do get that kind of shared history. Even though, it's funny, and I don't know if it's just because watching it again, after with everything that we now know,
yeah.
and all the big Finnish spin-offs and all that kind of thing. But it does feel like it's incredible to kind of watch this as just like only the second time she's been on screen.
Yeah, doesn't it? It does.
And you
forget that watching it again, knowing that there's so much to come.
Yeah.
But actually, maybe I think we said this in our Silence in the Library episode. I think that I really take my hat off to Alex Kingston, because from minute one, the performance is so well judged and rounded and there.
Mm-hmm.
She really does. I do just wonder if she was the only one who was given, you know.
Yeah, like, I think this is probably who you're going
to
be
privy to what they say.
Well, so, I mean, I can't imagine that not because, being the case, because by that point, Stephen Moffat knew he was going to probably take over.
Because her, knowing now what we know, that she is Amy's daughter,
yeah,
you look a little closer to her relationship with Amy in this episode.
Uh-huh.
And you actually feel like there is something prejudged there.
Yeah.
There's something interesting.
Definitely, and I do remember kind of
some kind of foreknowledge.
Watching it more closely this time around, like her interactions with Amy. Actually, there is a lot more to discuss. Shall we talk about the end?
Yes.
Let's talk about the end, because I remember that being quite a controversial.
Oh right, yes. Okay, you're not talking about you're talking about the
couple, the end, the end,
the bedroom scene.
The bedroom scene. Yeah. Now, I can see why people have a problem with it.
Yeah.
And I was like, I've always tried to defend it, but well, look, you know, if you're in like a high, what's the word, high stress situation, right, with a person, and they save your life, there's probably going to be some kind of like mixed feelings, some kind of, you know, attraction, because this person saved your life.
Yeah.
You know, this person, you know, and all that kind of thing. However, watching it again this time, I said, this is a bit, it feels like a scene from Coupling. It doesn't feel like, doesn't feel like Doctor Who. And it's an odd, there's some jokes in it, which when I watched the time, I was like, this time I was like, oh, Jesus.
Well, this also lends, I think, credence to my idea that this was written first, before the 11th hour, because I slightly feel uncomfortable with the, well, come on, let's finish the Prosecco, right. Mark, come on.
Well, I was going to open my bottle of Bishop's Finger, which would have fit in quite nicely with our militarised church.
Well, you want to do that and I'll just polish up your Prosecco. There's an unsavoury thought about Amy being sexually forward with the Doctor. The first time she encountered, like, considering that it's an obsession from childhood.
Yes.
There's something a bit weird there. And I felt uncomfortable because we've essentially got the same situation in the girl in the fireplace.
But not quite as on the nose.
Not quite as on the nose. It's kind of forgivable because you've got just 45 minutes. But you can really flesh it out here. A little girl who's grown up and has like a major sexual fantasy about her imaginary friend.
Yeah.
There's something slightly odd there, which makes me think that if he'd written them in order, would he have still gone for that story idea? Would he have placed the initial meeting as a child and then continued it in a kind of sexually forward sort of way? Now, what I would also say as well, maybe it's fine, because what I do remember from the time is that the only people who were actually complaining about this were men. I don't remember a lot of women complaining about this.
Ah, and that's interesting, yeah, maybe.
And
maybe.
If you think about it,
well, the power is very much in her.
Yeah, you know, like,
it's not like she's,
yeah,
yeah.
She, you know, she's just doing what, let's face it, and I don't mean to set this up like I'm a total misogynist or something like that, but I think if anybody thinks for a moment about, am I doing the right thing? Am I marrying this person? Is this the person I want to spend the rest of my life with?
Yeah.
Men seem, it seems to be like the purview of men. It seems to be a male thing of the stag party and the thinking about it.
Yeah.
It's not often reflected, what the female perspective
is. No, that's true.
And presumably, as human beings, they have exactly the same thoughts which is, am I doing the right thing? Is this what I want to do?
I like that you say presumably. I would imagine they absolutely do.
No, I know. I meant it.
I mean, obviously, but...
I meant it ironically.
I imagine that people do marry people they want to marry. But
so I think in the programme that we like, yes, it's uncomfortable. But as a character choice, on her wedding night, the magic that she's believed in all her life is proclaimed to be real, and more than that, it is a world of complete and utter adventure outside of this drab little village existence. Yeah. Why would you not suddenly feel like that?
In terms of metatextually,
yes,
it also then serves as kind of, well, I say that based on the little DVD extra.
Yeah.
Which there is, which is like a little scene.
Oh, the meanwhile in the TARDIS, yeah.
In which it becomes this kind of comment on, and it almost seems, and actually no, it's present in the scene. It almost seems like Stephen Moffat is going, look, we've had the pretty boy doctor that wants to kiss everybody,
yeah,
and he's doing it in the most extreme way possible to go, this is not this guy.
Yeah.
Like, maybe with River Song, and we'll maybe deal with that later.
Yeah.
This character should be with this guy,
yeah,
and the Doctor is going to make sure that that happens,
yeah,
and he doesn't want to be this romantic, but he's done with that.
Yeah.
Which,
as a scene, he then, in deep breath, does, he's obviously grown as a writer, so does better in one line.
Definitely.
I'm not your boyfriend, Clara,
Yeah.
And never said it was your mistake. It was that. I don't know. I know why it causes an uncomfortability. I see, though, the two ways why it's fine. What you're saying about changing the nature of the Doctor.
Yeah.
And I guess what I'm saying as well, which is, I don't think I've ever encountered, and, if you're listening, please say, I don't think I've ever encountered a woman who's been unhappy with that scene. Because it does show a nuanced...
Yeah.
A nuanced... confused female idea.
Yeah, I think... I've never encountered a woman.
Well, let's see if we can set up some special guests for forthcoming episodes.
I would love to have a female guest in this, not to proposition her. I mean, just in general,
It would be interesting to pick this back up again, because I know that this is the kind of the start of where people. Some people do have a problem with the way Stephen Moffat writes women, female companions. So it'd be interesting to get a female perspective on
to get her own female competitors.
Yeah.
We've talked about our favourite scenes.
Yeah.
Favourite performances. I mean, Ian Glen for me. Aside from the regulars, who are all fantastic.
Well, the regular, but I mean, in this case, knowing that we know it is their first one, I reckon we should. I'm going to give it to Matt Smith.
Why not?
And
Adam
Gillen. I think Matt Smith is great as the Doctor, but I think there's some really great stuff from Karen.
Do you know what I really love about Amy Pond? Is when, the museum scene.
Yeah.
Where she's just, she's in this, amazing museum. Well, it's an old church, but, in terms of the story. She's in this museum with this alien world. She's traveling through time and space, and she's bored.
Yeah.
I just love that as a concept.
Yeah.
It's just, can we go somewhere else?
Three episodes in, But then she's been spoiled, really, hasn't she? A space whale and Britain in the future, and then met Winston Churchill.
Yeah.
And now.
Now she's just in a stuffy old museum.
Yeah.
It's like, well.
Which looks like any country church.
Yeah.
which looks like they made a museum of a Philip Larkin poem. I think that's a laugh.
Okay. I think I do feel like it's something they maybe come back to.
Yeah.
Like Amy being bored by something.
Yes.
I think they definitely do in The Hungry Earth.
Yeah.
And Cold Blood, I think that's something that comes back. It's quite a funny character trait.
Although conversely, I liken that where the Doctor's just ticking off a list going, me, done that.
Yeah.
I done that. That was me. Don't even close.
Yeah.
I do think it's quite funny that one of the marked differences between classic Doctors and modern Doctors is that the modern Doctor's kind of bought into his own myth and he's kind of enjoying it.
Yeah.
Like that. Now it turns sinister, but there's a great period in this series where people go,
ooh. Which I think is the perfect follow on from Russell T. Davis's Doctor Who, because that's very much about him building his own legend. And then that can only go so far, and then it has to kind of come back down again.
Yeah.
Of which more next year, I guess.
Yeah.
Probably won't be next year. But yeah, so I think that's kind of...
I feel like we've dusted everything.
Right. Yeah.
Well, okay. Bottom line, because I don't know.
Well, yeah,
Did you like it?
I feel like we've maybe been a bit harsh on it, but...
I think we've been very balanced, but on the balance, did you like it?
Yeah, I do.
Did you hate it?
I do like it.
Does it deserve its, 53, 54 space in the 5 decades post?
Yeah, I think... I wouldn't necessarily...
Just in case Colin Baker's listening and we need to...
I mean, me personally, I wouldn't necessarily put it higher, but I certainly wouldn't put it any lower than 50. I think it's great. I think it's...
It was nice to have revisited it.
Definitely. It was just a really... I watched it last night and it was just a really enjoyable way to spend an hour and a half.
Yeah.
Just like...
Hi. Well, there. Hey.
Smashing.
There you go.
Smashing.
All right.
Well,
we're going to take a little break.
We are.
We'll get some other drinks in. And then we're coming back with Earthshock.
Should I explain why before, or do you want me to do that after the jingle?
Nah, go then. Explain why then.
Well, I think when we were talking about it in a pub somewhere, because that's how we plan these things.
Yeah.
It just immediately came to mind. And I think the only reason it came to mind was Cave, old enemy.
Military force. Yeah.
And then also the kind of aliens.
Yeah.
Because I think there's various elements of the set in Earthshock have been cannibalised from the set of Alien.
Okay.
I think. I might need to double check that, but I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
But then also just in general, it feels like Alien. It's a spaceship. Yeah. There's something on board that's killing off the crew. However, it feels more like Aliens, which came out a year or two later, because it's just louder, it's noisier, and I don't really care about any of the characters.
Well... Well, all right, we're back. Earthshock. Well, now, Mark, I noticed you have a drink on the table.
Uh huh. It's a bottle of Stouffer Press.
Yeah. What? I don't see. Like, what is that to do with Earthshock?
It's cider, man.
Christ. Fuck me. Alright, we're calling it a day at 50 episodes. That's the end.
This is how it ends.
Hope you've enjoyed, listeners. This is...
Not with a bang, but with a whimper. Earthshock.
Okay.
Written by... Eric
Mark's Sayward. Favourite pal. It's Eric Sayward.
And directed by...
Peter Grimwade. The dream team of Eric Sayward and Peter Grimwade.
Sayward, Grimwade. Turner.
Davison, the dream team.
But where do you think the dream team
got
in the first 5 decades, Paul?
This is going to form the crux of our chat.
It certainly is.
It is the experience we've had watching it over the... perception of the episode, which I believe to be a high.
But then, in terms of our listeners,
yes,
seem to back our own opinion up, and it's all got very confusing. I don't know what to believe anymore.
Well, so, okay, flash forward. Let's just guess. Is it 60?
It probably should be, but it's... 24.
That is unaccountable.
It's 24.
24. Between.
Between the five doctors at 25.
Well, we've already had a falling out with the five doctors.
And the vastly superior two of the Cybermen at 23.
Okay. 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 The five doctors. That's what's most annoying.
Now, listener correspondence. Now, I think listeners can already discern that the two of us are not particularly happy. And if anybody follows me on Twitter, they'll know my opinions of.
Let's just go over a chat we had.
Okay, right. We'll do that first.
So you texted me. What did you say?
I said something like...
Oh, basically said it was insufferable shit, I think. I think it was the gist.
Yeah, a tedious and overrated load of old toot.
Right, okay. So that's where Mark stands on the situation.
Yeah.
Now, at this point, I hadn't watched it. And the last time I had, which I don't think was... And this is it was 15 years ago. The DVD came out. The DVD came out in 2003.
It
was part of that 40th anniversary. And I don't think I've watched it since. Because I don't think I came away with a particularly favourable feeling about it.
Sure.
Ever since then, I've heard it's one of the greats. You know, people, you know, like it's high up in the polls. People often refer to it as being, if you're going to look at like a good modern Cyberman story, it's Earthshock. And I was prepared to sit down, watch it, be blown away, and propose that this episode be entitled Verthshock because of my, you know, Road to Damascus
Indeed.
Moment.
I mean, I still say we should call it that anyway, just because it's a good pun. It's a really good pun. So you and I were under the impression that maybe we were the exception that proved the rule.
Yeah.
However, we've had... So, Enthusiasm Paul on Twitter. I don't know if it's the same Paul from Facebook.
Paul McAvoy, yeah.
Earthshock is a black hole of hype.
Yes.
Yeah? I agree with you there.
Which is a great phrase.
It is a great phrase.
That's what Facebook is made for. good sentence. Oh, is it Twitter, was it?
Yeah, Twitter's made for... That's Facebook's what Facebook's made for just long, rambling nonsense.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
David Parkinson, there's a kind of...
There's Parky Dave. Parky Dave.
There's... This is kind of still following off with it. Ian Glenn in The Time of Angels reminds me of a rejuvenated Bernard Horsfall, which is funny because I'd rather fall off a horse and burn hard than watch Earthshock more than twice. And our, you know, old reliable Jeff Waddle, Earthshock, I've always found it extremely overrated.
Yeah.
And my former colleague and good friend
just nailing
it. Yeah, he's just nailing it.
There's no point in continuing. He's just nailing it.
Just follow. What we'll do is we'll tell Jeff what episodes we're going to talk about, and then you just follow him on Twitter, and then Ben and I can take a month off.
Yeah, we don't have to. He's nailing this.
And my former colleague and good friend Les simply puts Beryl Reed, Space Pirate. So our opinions are backed up by our audience.
Well, no.
So we're preaching to the converted here.
No, I think we are in for a verth shock, because actually, mate, I did enjoy it. And so a lot of the criticism I have about Time of Angels, this is why I think it was a great pairing, it's too long, and there's an over-reliance on creating atmosphere and chilling feeling. And like episode one is all padding.
Episode one of the best episodes.
Yeah, but it's all padding. But it is the best because it genuinely has an atmosphere.
Yeah.
I don't think this would be my number... There's still a lot of 80s Doctor Who problems with it.
This is where it starts for me. But, I think this story in particular is... And obviously it's the last one that Anthony Root is credited as the script editor, but it's very much Eric Sayward was writing and editing.
But I love the Cybermen. I love the Cybermen in this. Do you not?
Right. I want to just clarify that. Okay. I'm shaking my head. They couldn't tell that, but you called the picture to it, so I'm going to need to know.
I said I love the Cybermen in this, and Mark looked like he was going to spit on me.
I love the design of the Cybermen.
Yep.
I think David Banks is fantastic as the cyber leader.
Yeah.
However...
Although he's quite chompy. Especially in episode four, he's quite chompy.
Yeah, that's...
What does he say? Is there something... And then...
It's a really good... Yeah.
We're going to destroy you.
Yeah.
I don't know what he says, but I just go, God, it's like your old... It's like your old granddad after Sunday lunch.
Albert Steptoe in a silver flight suit. No, I think this, in a design point of view, I think the Cybermen are great. Yeah. I think David Banks is very good. But when did it... Why is it that every time the Cybermen turn up now, certainly in this period of Doctor Who, and since probably it's always the focus is on, oh, we want to destroy Earth. And it's like, you were conceived as a fucking thing about, like limb replacement, and you know, and about like upgrading your body, and you know, like, and how that's a dangerous thing, and you lose touch with humanity.
Yeah.
Why is it writers always focus on this? We would like to destroy the Earth, like every other villain in Doctor Who.
Absolutely.
And that really fucks me off because the Cybermen is such a great concept, and I think I put it up on the 50th anniversary of Part One, The Tenth Planet.
Yes.
And I said, you know, happy 50th birthday to Simon. Hopefully one day a writer will remember the good thing about the concept.
Yeah, yeah. No, I absolutely agree with that. They are... that this absolutely could be a Dalek story.
It could be any fucking story.
Ice Warriors. Yeah. It could be Draven.
It
could be anything.
It could be anything. It could be the Master.
Yeah.
It could be anything.
Yeah.
This is not... I remember before I watched it again this time, I put it on Twitter, I was just about to watch Earthshock with, you know, substandard sci-fi actioner, terrible fucking Cyberman story, Earthshock. Because it is, it's not a Cyberman story.
No, but...
And that's the thing that annoys me about it. Everybody's like, oh yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, the Cybermen are amazing. And I wonder if it's that thing that we've always talked about on this podcast of the gatekeepers of Doctor Who fandom, the people that grew up with Doctor Who while it was on the television. And this was like a... You know, the end of episode one was a big reveal. Nobody knew it was going to happen.
No, I think the excitement of seeing the Cybermen back.
Yeah.
Well, this episode falls within the birth of modern fandom, right?
Yeah,
so
this is
on the 2-year approach to the 20th anniversary of Doctor Who. This is modern fandom, and let's face it.
Not even 2 years. It's 80.
It's 81.
82 when it went out.
This is it. Okay, right. Okay, because it's got a time code at the end of the episode for 81.
No,
maybe it's just a case of when it's been recorded and...
Recorded, I would imagine.
So we're on the approach to the 20th anniversary. There is a fever about Doctor Who. Doctor Who is, bizarrely, for all the kind of the naysaying that we give 80s Doctor Who, particularly Davison Doctor Who, this is, fuck you, Mark, the most momentous, most popular period of Doctor Who outside the Dalek mania, and that brief
the run up to the 20th
and you don't just have the return of the Cybermen, you have William Hartnell and Patrick Troughton and Tom Baker making an appearance as well,
right?
It is just, you know, I think continuity, mythology. And generally, do you know what? The Cybermen are not embarrassing in this.
No, they're not.
They're not the Cybermen of excellent. They are... there's a genuine threat. There's a genuine tension. They are genuinely sinister. There is some great atmosphere. I'm not saying this amounts to a great serial.
Yeah.
But I was actually pleasantly surprised when I did come to watch it that I think that it falls into a middle ground. It's not terrible, but it's not the best thing you've ever seen.
The thing is, I agree with you that the Cybermen are a threat and that, you know... Yeah. I agree with what you're saying there, but the problem that I have with it is the problem I have with every single fucking... Well, not every single...
Yeah.
I love Kinder. I'll probably die going, I hate the Davison era, but I really love Kinder.
Yeah.
Every single fucking problem with the 80s Doctor Who is in this script.
Yeah.
And this is where it starts, and this is where the rot sets in.
Yeah. Well, you're saying you don't like the characters.
Any of the characters. Yeah,
yeah. Well, I mean, I like a lot of the characters, I just don't like the central...
There's so many of them!
I don't like the central four.
There's so many of them.
I think all of the regulars are fucking awful actors. And I would have given anything to see this story done by any other Doctor. Because there is something in this, and I don't know if it's still... We're still early in the Davison era. Davison, and I know he doesn't listen, so fuck him. He's
a nice man in real life.
Maybe. You know what? Maybe. But there's a lot of bullshit that Sylvester McCoy and Colin Baker take, which reason Davison is exempt from.
I don't get
it. You know
that.
What? He is the least honest, the least truthful, and the least natural Doctor's performance.
Yeah.
He is... There's a lot of stuff that you just think... You are balancing affectation really unsteadily with whatever bullshit lines you're given. There's a bit where he's constantly, like, he's trying to avoid, you know, that first episode where they're talking about Adric wanting to go home, and he's constantly, like, he's looking at a bit of machinery, or he's looking at a rock, and it's like he's just woggling it about, and you're not looking at it, you're just doing some weird hand acting to go along with your automatic talking acting. It's bullshit. And the only one of the regulars that comes away with this with any degree of I don't know dignity is Janet Fielding. She's the only actual truthful, honest actor in this thing, or of the regulars.
Yeah, she's absolutely excellent.
Nyssa is, honestly, I don't get.
And this comes down to my too many characters thing. So what you have is the Doctor, Nyssa, Tegan and Adric materialise in a cave. They meet a bunch of soldiers or whatever. Then they take them on board the TARDIS. Then they go on a spaceship and meet like six more characters. So much so that at one point, Nyssa and a character who you've only met a couple of weeks ago that you've not really been told that much about.
I watched over a course of 3 days. By the time I came to episode 4, I was like, who's that?
Yeah.
Who's that in the
TARDIS? Exactly. And then you're supposed to care when they get gunned down.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is my this is my problem with Eric Sayward's Doctor Who, is that, like, I don't necessarily have an issue with massive loss of life.
Yeah.
But you've got to care about the people. Otherwise it just becomes cannon fodder and it becomes meaningless. And that's what he does. He just fills the screen with these people that are there for the purpose of being killed by the baddies.
It's Resurrection of the Cybermen.
Yeah.
When you get part 3 and 4, it's Resurrection of the Cybermen.
It's cynical, it's unpleasant, and I really have my issues with it. And you watch this now with the benefit of hindsight and go, well, all the warning signs are there.
Yeah.
Like,
well, I mean, I get why, to get rid of the cyber leader, the Doctor's got to grind Adric's star into the chest.
Yeah, that's fine.
But then, like, the proper holding up of the gun to the chest, you're blasting him.
Yeah. It's essentially that thing in, like, action movies where, like, you know, the hero shoots somebody in the chest, but they're not quite dead yet. And he takes a gun and just shoots them in the fucking head.
Which really, there's somebody said, I can't remember who said it on Facebook or Twitter, somebody said, I would take Attack of the Cybermen over this.
You're right, I think it was Paul, I think he said that.
Paul, absolutely, absolutely. And there's a bit at the end of Attack of the Cybermen where the Doctor's being chased around by the cyber controller.
Yes, yeah.
And, you know, the 16th Doctor and Colbaker took a lot of shit for going, I just gunned down the Cybermen.
Yeah.
And, like, well, he was in far more of a defensive and desperate situation than the 5th Doctor and the TARDIS was.
Oh, definitely.
You know. And this is what I'm talking about. Do you know what? I would rather have seen this as a Colin Baker story, or a Sylvester McCoy story, or any other Doctor story. Yeah. I think it would have come out with flying colours after this.
You're right, because I've got a note here that says, the Doctor doesn't use his wits, he just murders the cyber leader.
Doesn't even try and do like that thing that maybe would have happened in the Trouton era, just like boof him out the door. Just like
boof him out the door.
Just like get him around the door, boof him out the door. Do a salamander on the fucking guy.
I just think the script is terrible. I think the plotting is terrible. Like the bit where they spend all that time trying to like trap the Cyberman in the door.
Yeah.
And then they just come in the other door and the Doctor goes, oh, I should have realised.
Oh, I should have realised.
I was like, what? There's two fucking doors.
But this is what I'm talking about. Like, a better actor.
A
better actor would have sold that. A better director would have hidden that from the view of the audience. A better writer would just have not done two doors.
Not written in a fucking script.
Would not have done two doors. He would have had a main door and then maybe like a bit of the side.
Or like a hatch or something. Yeah. Or like I should have realised I could have got in through the hatch.
There was a transporter system and they beamed in or something like that.
And the thing is, I remember watching our show for the first time and enjoying it.
Yes, because it is. Like Resurrection of the Daleks, it is very viscerally enjoyable.
Yeah.
Right? If all you're looking for is surface thrills, boom, these are your two stories.
I think that's it. I think when you're younger, or certainly when I was younger, you do kind of gravitate towards, like, guns and action and explosions.
But also, it is directed all right.
Yes.
Episode one of the caves, very evocative.
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah.
When you get on the freighter.
I remember watching that first episode for the very first time. I think I watched it. It was either on UK Gold or on VHS from a friend of mine that was also in the Doctor Who, and just being like, this is great. Yeah. Like, this is really great. in terms of the atmosphere, in terms of how everything kind of builds up to the big reveal at the end. And I remember really enjoying it, but watching it now, I'm just like, it's a lot of characters.
I didn't feel so deflated, because maybe since I haven't seen it in 15 years, it felt like a new
Doctor Who. I haven't seen it in a long time, but if I'm gonna
say anything, I think I actually, so we talked about Frontiers, so I think that was the most recent Davison that we've done, and we quite liked
it.
And I think
Five Doctors.
Fuck the Five Doctors.
No, we did Planet of Fire quite recently.
Did we? Okay.
Which I actually liked.
Well, the thing is, I think I enjoyed it better than Frontiers, the Five Doctors from Planet of Fire. I think I enjoyed it more than these. I mean,
I'm not saying you're wrong.
I get it, but I think I'm just more willing to, because I don't know, there's just something about 80s Cybermen that I will constantly forgive.
I think the 80s Cybermen are great. I really
do. Like everything that orbits around.
But my problem with the 80s Cybermen is not the design, it's not the act, it's not the performance.
Yeah.
It's the justification, it's the stories that they're putting.
Oh, I don't care about the
And it's always...
One of my favourite Doctor Who's is Silver Nemesis. Who cares? That's never a Cyberman story.
And that's, like, the thing is that I love the Cybermen as a concept.
Yeah.
And they've never been...
No, they haven't.
It's always about destroying the Earth.
Yeah. But then maybe that's what they've become.
I really want somebody to change that. Because even Neil Gaiman, who I thought could have done something really interesting with them in Nightmare on Silver, essentially it's just that, oh, well, we're going to just rebuild our army and then just destroy a bunch of planets.
Also, here's some children.
Yeah, also here's some really annoying children. And Tamsin Outhwaite.
Was she in that?
I'm sure she's in that.
I was absolutely bluted when I saw that, and I haven't watched it since either.
I look forward to watching it for this. But I just feel that Earthshock, for me, marks the point where...
I just think episode...
I think 80s Doctor Who starts to go on a decline, and where 80s Doctor Who, much like Adric in his spaceship, is on a... irreversible crash.
Yeah. Which is bizarre because you could argue that series, that first Davison series, is the most adventurous in 20 years of Doctor Who, to 19 years of Doctor
Who. I think there's some really, really interesting... I mean, I quite like Forward to Doomsday. You regenerate a doctor
after 7 years.
Yeah.
To be a completely different personality takes over from the classic.
Yeah, a younger actor.
Seven-year giant that was Tom Baker. Then you actually go ahead and... it's not just like a Katarina thing, you know, in Dalek Master.
Yeah.
You actually kill a companion and then give them like a proper like silent scrawling type.
Yeah.
And then the very next one... You get rid of your other... In Time Flight, you get rid of your other...
Yeah, but the thing is, right, this is no fucking Face the Raven, right?
Yeah.
You know, what they do with that is they kill off Clara.
No.
Right, let me finish. Right. They kill off Clara, then you give a whole episode which is about grief and about loss. And then, because I watched the start of Time Flight after this, because I was like, no, I can't remember. I watched the start of Time Flight. And all the time, the Doctor's like, "Oh, I've dropped off all the characters from Earthshock.
Yeah.
The multitude of characters that we ended up with, they've all gone home safely." And Tegan's like, "Oh yeah, but what about Adric?" I said, "Well, you know, he wouldn't want us to mourn unnecessarily." Right, we're off to.
he says the words, "Let's go on an adventure."
Yeah,
to cheer us all up.
Yeah, and it's like. Really? So, like, if you don't give a fuck, why should I care?
Yeah.
Like, it's,
We do know that
if you're going to kill off a character, make sure it counts.
Yes, yeah, but this is what I'm talking about. I mean, this is not modern Doctor Who. There's an attempt to do something adventurous and new.
Yeah.
And unfortunately shocking. Like, John Nathan Turner understood Doctor Who, but not really.
Mm.
Or not in a modern, caring sensibility.
Yeah.
He thought...
Oh, it's an empty shot.
He was applying the same... Like,
because that's...
Jonathan Turner would have been the best soap producer. That's what he was attempting to do. He was creating Doctor Who as a soap. Now, maybe, very well, that's, you know, down to the fact that it was put on a Tuesday and a Thursday like a soap.
Like a soap.
So he had to start applying that marketing mindset to the thing, you know.
I am an avid EastEnders watcher.
Yeah.
And, you know, I very much with each production company, with each, sorry, producer that comes in, I think they respect those, certainly the long-running characters.
Yeah.
I was watching it this time, I'm like, well, what really does kill Adric?
Yeah.
It's this kind of odd obsession.
Well, it's his own ego.
It's his own ego, it's his own obsession, and fighting, that's a really interesting thing to play with, but I don't think it's dealt with in an interesting way.
Yeah, do you think it's just a joke that got out of hand? Because I never particularly thought of Adric as an egotistical character, but what we learn from reading up on production is that certainly Matthew Waterhouse might be considered as an egotistical actor.
Allegedly,
so do you think?
Yes,
well, so do you think that they just kind of went, well, we'll dispatch him by, you know, hoist by the actor's own petard, as
it were. The thing is, I mean, I presume he doesn't know that the ship's going to crash into prehistoric Earth.
Well, he must do, because he's the one who sort
of... because then why does he care about... Is it just to crack the logic puzzle and save the day?
No, no, it's not, because he jumps out of the escape pod because he knows what the answer is to disarm the cyber bomb, whatever the logic device is. However, whilst he's typing in the final sequence,
the wounded Cyberman
comes in, blows up the console, so he can never, like, so he can't stop.
But
the
ship's always going to crash.
No, because if the Cyberman hadn't came in, he would have stopped it.
Yeah, but then, I just think it's really poorly executed.
Because
everybody else is just like, we better get in the escape pod.
It's poorly written, it's poorly directed, and he's a terrible actor. So you've got the unholy trilogy of bullshit, which have made that not a very good ending.
Yeah.
And we're still supposed to care silence. So when this silent scroll happens, you think, is this like a Acorn Antiques thing? Is this like a Victoria Wood piss take of Doctor Who or something? Because I don't care about what's just happened.
No,
and I find that laughable.
Yeah, I just, oh God, everything about Earthshock just fucking, no, it just screams as a warning, just like, turn the ship around, you're gonna crash. You're going to just wipe out the whole of the dinosaurs.
Also, why does fitting a bit of Cyberman technology to a ship in the 25th century suddenly cause it to go back in time? And it's such a bullshit. Don't they say something like to explain, like, well, it's so unpredictable when you have a bit of cyber technology sitting on your bridge.
Well, so unpredictable that you can travel through time. Yeah. Something that this program has established is quite difficult.
Yes, it's the very ship that the Doctor is making this observation from has been long established as being
a complex,
technological mindfuck of a marvel.
Fucking hate it.
the fact that they've set up previously in episode one the talk of, we never knew what killed the dinosaurs and hit the earth. And you go, well.
Oh, so you'll deal with that at the end, right?
Eric Sayward's pulled the eye of his typewriter going, I am so smart.
Yeah.
I am smart. I have done really good script writing here. I have this has got a cyclical nature. I'm going to earn my renter bonus.
Yeah, exactly. It's
wait until I show Anthony Root.
I quit. 24 out of 241.
Where's Resurrection of the Daleks? Because they're basically
exactly the same problem.
Because they are one and the same. That'd be interesting to find out.
That is an interesting point.
Because Resurrection does take a lot of shit.
It does.
Because, you know, I'm not going to lie, I did enjoy this. Everything you said, I appreciate, I see, but I did enjoy this. Yeah, okay, here we are. Resurrection of the Daleks is 99.
Right, okay.
Between the androids of Tara and the massacre of a St. Bartholomew's Eve. Is it just that Resurrection of the Daleks is... At least Ashok disguises his grimness. Where Resurrection of the Daleks is just... from moment one, it's just like, it's a constant...
But
like
does
that.
It disguise his grimness? Because in one of the best bits, I think, is when the androids gun down two of the scientists, and there's just this kind of horrible gloop with a name badge in it.
Yeah. And like a gloopy old hand holding the speaking machine.
That's really horrible. Whereas, you know, I think that is horrible, but you kind of let it go.
Yeah.
Whereas with Resurrection, that's a bit grim, it's a bit unpleasant. But is that because at the end of it, there's nobody left other than the Doctor, Tegan and Turlough?
Maybe.
Whereas with this, everybody fucks off on an escape pod.
Yeah.
And some characters you've not been made to care about die.
Yeah.
And Adric dies. Yeah. And let's face it, nobody really cares.
Yeah.
Is that maybe it?
I don't know.
Is that there's a higher survival rate in Earthshock than there is in Resurrection?
Maybe. I don't know. Because it's got the same thing, you know, like if, you know, it's got Daleks and it's got a little flashback to Hartnell and
Trent. Yeah, which is lovely to see.
I don't know. Maybe it's just because it's got Beryl Reed and people think of it better. Now, let's talk about
Beryl Reed.
Let's talk about Beryl Reed.
My note here says, you know, you want Sigourney Weaver, but what you get is Mrs. Noah.
Now, do you? Because I've seen this encountered an awful lot where they go, well, she was miscast. It should have been like Ripley, you know.
Not even Ripley, just, like, because the whole idea is that she's like a bit of a mercenary, a bit of a space pirate.
No, it's not.
She's Han Solo, essentially.
No, she isn't. That's not Han. Beryl Reed was miscast. She's perfectly cast. Like, the character is Beryl Reed. The comparison I make is that when we first encounter them, and it's before the Doctor showed up,
negotiating with them, yeah.
Yeah. What we get is basically that same sort of capitalist, corporate, every ship is a franchise rather than part of any kind of thing.
Yeah,
which you get
in, which
you get in Robots of Death, say.
Yeah.
Or you get as that outlook on Earth in the Sunmakers.
Yes.
Yeah. So when somebody's reporting to her that like four people have gone missing, and she's going, oh, typical, right? I don't see a younger, more, you know, karate chop type of action. I see exactly this bizarre ginger permed capitalist, you know, grandmother that we get.
Yeah, okay, I see what you're saying.
You know, because at no point is she called upon to do, and really, when you see those characters. You know, the ship's on the collision course, it's flitting through time for some reason.
Yeah.
And they're all panicking around the console. They look like, I guess, what they're supposed to be, which are just people who are essentially gold prospectors from the Yukon, but the situation has changed.
Yeah.
They've all been lumped onto a ship together. Nominally, somebody's been called captain because they've maybe been the longest in service. And for the first time, they've been given an actual situation that they've got to try and get their way out of. And they are ill-prepared for it. They're panicked. They're, you know, like, you know. I think the casting of Beryl Reed is perfect. What's also perfect about that is that even after Adric dies in episode four, Matthew Waterhouse is credited below Beryl Reed, who gets second billing after the Doctor. So it's great. It's great seeing like that kind of ground-up star, and then silently the Doctor, Peter Davison. Beryl Reed.
Yeah.
what am I watching? What ITV sitcom season am I watching?
I think it's Stu, our good friend Stu.
Makes it perfectly conceivable why several thousand Cybermen are able to sneak themselves aboard the cargo of her ship. Where she goes, what do you mean? The cargo silos?
Oh no! We'll get to that in a minute.
It's like I didn't give a shit about what came aboard my ship because I just want money. Sorry, anyway.
No, but that's a good point. I'll come to in a minute. But no, he was like, you know, because I sort of put up that I found that Earthshock was just shit, near irredeemable shit. And he was like, oh, come on, you know, that's not bad. You know, I agree that maybe Beryl Reed is a sign of things to come. I was like, Beryl Reed? She's not even the worst of it. But that is the kind of consensus, isn't it? That Beryl Reed kind of leads to Ken Dodd, to Nicholas Sparks,
which
are excellent.
They are. Ken Dodd is amazing.
Yeah.
Right? And
Nicholas Parsons is incredible.
Ken Dodd probably does the best death in 80s Doctor Who. And Nicholas Parsons gives...
is one of the finest performances in... Yeah,
yeah, yeah. It's emotionally shattering.
So, yeah. So, I agree with you that maybe it's...
Hale and Pace are amazing in Survivor. John Nathan Turner was fucking brilliant. Yes, let's treat Doctor Who like light entertainment, because it does better than hiring actual bullshit actors.
Yeah, maybe. But the thing is that RTD kind of has that same sort of John Nathan Turner mischievousness,
yes,
in casting, which I think he got away with it a lot more, Russell T.
Yes.
But it's the same principle. It's like, well, you get people talking about the programme. And I think that's...
He does it more smartly. He manages to get Barbara Windsor to be in Doctor Who.
Which was a masterstroke.
Yeah. By appearing in a little spoof bit of EastEnders.
Yeah.
He gets... Anne Widdecombe?
Yes, yeah, Anne Widdecombe, yeah.
He gets McFly.
Yeah, it's, you know, that is that. It's, you know, it's that kind of... It's like Strictly Come Dancing. It's just Strictly Come Dancing.
I'll tell you what, I mean, maybe it was not reflected in our reviews of the episodes, but I always, in the RTD years, I always looked forward to that.
The end of the season review. Yeah.
The end of the season. Yeah, like, I don't mean review. I mean like...
R-E-V-U-E.
Yeah, yeah. Like the comedy review. How do we get the most amount of celebrities into this? You know.
Yeah. So, I mean... That is something maybe we've lost a little bit.
Yeah.
But I think he was always a lot smarter with that. He always kind of knew how that could work.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, like, I don't think Beryl Reed's the worst thing in it at all.
No, she's not.
I think she's fine. It doesn't really bother me.
Beryl Reed has got the same kind of comedy caliber in terms of name. Like, if you were to go, who you cast as the captain? Kenneth Williams.
That'd be good.
Yeah. Well, you'd love to see that. You'd love
maybe
to see
Earthshock,
that.
Maybe not Earthshock, because I don't think...
And then you would see it and go, oh, fuck, that was amazing.
But you know what maybe the problem is? It's the tone that Eric Sayward sets up.
Yeah.
I don't think necessarily... I see what you're saying about Beryl Reed playing that character.
Yeah, yeah.
But maybe Beryl Reed within that production doesn't sit right.
I think Sayward creates a three-parter and a one-parter.
Yeah.
And he puts this atmospheric first episode. And then he tries to restart the adventure completely again. So he has all this kind of like...
Well, yeah, because there's that whole thing about, oh, there's a bomb. There's a big bomb that is going to blow up the Earth.
So rather than heighten that, he cuts it off. And then we go to episode two. We meet a whole new crew.
Yeah.
And meet them.
And the spaceship's the bomb.
Yeah, that episode one level of introduction.
Yeah. You know? Which is why I'm saying you just hemorrhage characters.
Yeah.
Because
you
just got.
Yeah.
But what I was going to say about the Cybermen being on board is that it tries to do that really iconic Tomb of the Cybermen thing.
Yeah.
And actually, also, they kind of do it in The Invasion as well. But that kind of bursting out of these things. It's just Simon covered in cling film.
Yeah.
I said, oh, I've got some cling film. I can't get it off. it really detracts from the kind of the moment.
I quite like the idea that
it's just like wrapped in plastic. To quote Twin Peaks.
Yeah, but the cyber race are like IKEA furniture. we fixate on the idea that they are half human, half robot.
Yeah.
But what they are is that they are products, they are produce, and that they are
a way to... Now,
which is a fascinating idea and something that maybe should be dealt with in the television programme.
And was not.
Yeah. But you're right. I mean, that is what it is. It's, and I think they fudged it a bit in Rise of the Sandman, because I think the idea of bringing them back and saying, well, yeah, what we'll do is we'll do it as a product, as a kind of like this branding thing of like how humanity will survive.
Yeah.
Great concept. Mark Platt, who, you know, I guess originated that with Spare Parts. Fantastic. However, it's never really been realised that well on screen.
And with Rise of the Cybermen, Age of Steel, the fact that you have these CGI scenes of the cyber factories, and they're so gruesome and violent, as buzz saws and hacksaws all over the place. And actually, I like the idea that was suggested right back in the 10th Planet. You know, the fact there's like the kind of the woolen socked face thing. The idea that it's just incrementally, bit by bit, the body is taken apart.
And they're essentially bandages that they've got over there.
Yeah. I mean, the original Cybermen, I think, work because they look like they're just at a hospital.
Yeah. Well, I've said this, I think I've said this, told this story before, but I remember Halloween when I was, like, first year of uni, and we were all out on a night out, and a couple of my friends who were not into Doctor Who whatsoever, but they were showing like a documentary about robots on television or on film or just on screen in general on BBC Two that night, but it was being shown in the pub that we were in. So I'm dressed as Larry David and I looked up and I was like, oh, shit.
Right. To this point, you haven't stated that it was a costume party.
Well, we were out on Halloween.
Right.
So, I was dressed as Larry David.
The scariest thing you could think of.
My friend was dressed as Flavor Flav from Public Enemy. But anyway, so we're there, and
I didn't know Tarts and Vickers part.
No, it wasn't. And I can, obviously, I see a clip from the 10th Planet on the television in a pub and be like, have they found it? Have they found part four? Is this a news announcement?
And it's made national news.
Yeah. So I'm like looking up, and all right, it's just a clip for a documentary. But my friend Heather sort of looked up at the same point. She said, oh, like, what? As I thought to her, so that's really scary. Like, they're like really creepy looking.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yes, they are. Yeah. But they're not after that. But you're right. Yeah. It's that kind of. It's the surgery thing. It's the.
It's the idea that as a human, that bit by bit you are being rebuilt.
Yeah.
You know, for your benefit. And it's only when it's too late that you realise the majority of your body has been replaced.
Yeah.
Rather than the modern RTD version, which is that it's one violent swipe of a buzzsaw and there's a brain inside a metal body.
But I think also, as time has gone on, the Daleks have kind of cannibalised a lot of the Cyberman, the appeal of the Cyberman.
Yeah.
So Revelation of the Daleks, you know, they're turning human corpses into into Daleks.
Yeah.
That's a Cyberman story.
Yeah.
Revelation of the Daleks would have been a cracking Cyberman story.
Tobias Vaughn instead of Davros.
You know, it's, you know, and you know, I know it, not a lot of people like Dark Water and Death in Heaven. I know a lot of people don't like, actually, no, that's the best example. Yeah. I know a lot of people don't like Dark Water, Death and Heaven. But like, as a concept, and it's kind of a shame that it's not just a straight Cyberman story. It has to have this kind of added dimension of
the Master
and all that kind of thing. That is a great concept, that the Cybermen go, oh, well, we'll offer humanity a life beyond death.
But then like they decorate it with hokey, distracting elements, like... Cyber Brigadier, okay.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Let's talk about that.
Well, we'll do that in a couple of years' time.
Yeah. No.
But that's the thing, is I think Stephen Moffat totally gets and understands the concept of Cybermen, but it's just a shame it's never really been.
Yeah.
But he's not alone.
Yeah, I mean, so you know, like you can looking at the 10th Planet, what was it born out of? You know, the idea of the Cybermen. We're talking about in the fiction, is that, you know, these beings have done what they've done out of sheer desperation.
To survive.
And despair. Yeah. But more than that, it's been incremental. It's been awarded. You know, like they don't, like, and the reason the original Cybermen probably look like they do is the idea that it's been a quick fix.
Yeah.
But it's been, of all of their society, it's been piecemeal. Everyone kind of looks a bit like each other, but it's really good. There's not been enough funds to completely do it. We're not talking about the $6 million man. it's really been what we can do, what we can manufacture, what we can do, So, because we are doing this, we are talking about this, as I said, at the start of the episode, during the 50th anniversary of the 10th planet.
Yeah.
And so it's really interesting having watched this and having seen the 10th planet
as well.
I think
also, we're at an age now, I went to see Werner Herzog's documentary about the internet, lo and behold, the other day, and we're at a period now about artificial intelligence, about prosthetic limbs, and how people replace those. I think we're totally at a point at which the Cybermen can be a properly relevant concept.
Yeah.
But nobody seems either willing or seems to quite grasp.
When I was on the plane,
the zeitgeisty appeal
When I was on the plane coming back, they had a feature on the various, in Tokyo, of course, all of these hotels which make a premium of being robot managed.
Right.
So you will go in, and rather than encounter somebody behind the desk, it's the robot of a velociraptor for some reason. Just because it's funny as a robot. People like downstairs. Or is the robot.
There's a problem with a duck. Robot velociraptor.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Well, exactly. You'll go. So this hotel in Tokyo, and you go up to it, and there's a desk of maybe four or five, and each of them is a robot, but each of them is a different thing. So there's a velociraptor and a duck. And then there's a velociraptor of Mickey Mouse, or a robot of Mickey Mouse or something. And you go up to each of these, and you just conduct yourself going, tell you what, it was there was a recent ITV documentary about it was Joanna Lumley in the Far East. The imaginative titles ITV give to
Joanna Lumley goes to Japan.
Yeah exactly. And she goes in, and she goes to one of these robot hotels, and I would love to see a story where, what if somebody ran a Cyberman hotel?
There's so many brilliant ideas, and it really.
Oh, that's how it started. That's the doctor and Bill. The doctor, Bill, and Nardole arrive in a weird hotel with robots.
Yeah.
And then they pick up the newspaper and find out that this is Mondas.
Ben's arrangement of the Doctor Who theme tune can be found on Spotify from the 23rd of November.
1.99.
I'm done.
We're at the end of our talk. I don't think it was as bad. I enjoyed it. I get everything that you're saying, though, and all our wonderful contributors.
I just find this. I find it very problematic in terms of where Doctor Who goes from there.
Sure.
But I would say my favourite performance in the piece is David Banks as the Cyber Leader.
Yeah.
I think he's good. I like his kind of... Because it's... Which is maybe, again, it's not necessarily what the Cybermen should be, but it properly feels like the Doctor having a kind of face-to-face with a villain.
Yeah.
A villain with a character. I like that. I think that's...
Yeah. Janet Fielding. She's the only one...
Yeah.
That makes
it... Has like, stuff to do.
Yeah. Well, makes it look like some real thing is happening to an actual person. I don't believe that... I don't buy that the Doctor gives a shit. Nyssa is one-dimensional.
Yeah.
Adric... The problem with Adric's death is that it just looks like a guy acting that a person has to die at that moment. Janet Fielding is the only person that imbues it with any of the regulars of any actual human element.
She's wonderful. I'll never all my problems with the Davison era, I will never hear a bad word against Janet Fielding.
I'm not gonna fawn. Sometimes she's terrible. But in this, and when it matters, that's the thing, when it matters, Janet Fielding is the one to rely on. Absolutely. Absolutely. So yeah, okay, there you are. Well, you know, favourite scene. We didn't do that, did we? What's your favourite scene?
I don't think I have one. I mean, I've got, there's some nice images in it. I think the image of the Cyberman frozen in carbonite, as it was, you know, like through the door. I think that's quite cool.
Okay.
I think I love the image of the Cyber Leader in the TARDIS. I think that's a really cool image that we, you know, it's something we've not seen. So like, there's lots of really nice images in it, but I struggle to find a proper full on scene from beginning to end.
Okay. Well, maybe the in episode one, where I don't even know what the kind of the general's name, the with the moustache, the head guy,
Chunky Gilmore.
Yes, yeah. When he grabs the Doctor by the lapels and throws him against some rocks and says, "Too many people have died for you to play the fool."
Yeah, that's quite good.
I like that element. Because there is a greater nuance to that than just the general. We've talked about it before, but just the general kind of, "You're a spy!
Yeah.
You will die, Doctor!" acting. Like, there is a proper, with that character, there is a proper appraisal and sea change of character depending on the evidence that's given to them.
No, that's fair enough.
So I quite like that.
Cool.
Anyway, so that's our shock. Was it success? Was it not? I don't quite know. Okay, we asked for Time of Angels, Flesh and Stone. Mark, yes or no? Did you like it?
No. I think they know that I didn't like
it. Okay, good. Okay, I did.
But I surprised myself by how much I didn't like it, because I always thought that I liked Earth Shock. I'm watching it this weekend, and maybe I watched it the wrong time. I watched it after, you know, doing the London Film Festival for 2 weeks and kind of just being like in cinemas all day, every day. So maybe I wasn't in the best frame of mind for 80s Doctor Who.
So, I mean, I don't remember liking it, and then I watched it, and I kind of did like it. I don't think
swapped roles.
Well, I don't think it was quite the Road to Damascus moment.
Okay.
So I don't think we can call it Verth Shock. But maybe if we call it Verth Shock with a question mark at the end, that might work in this episode. Alright, well, okay.
Next time.
Thank you very much, guys. But next time,
we Vampires and Menace.
Yes.
And I think we've decided to pair this up with The Mask of Mandragora.
Yes.
Because we want to talk about, well, I mean, I have a fondness. The two holidays I've been on that I've just absolutely fucking loved is Italy.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to go for, you know, a bit of Renaissance era Italy.
Yeah, you went on a stag party to Renaissance.
Yeah, by myself.
Yeah.
With a strange intergalactic time traveller. So we're going to talk about Vampires of Venice and Mask of Mandragora.
Yes.
And Renaissance here at Italy and all that entails.
All that jazz.
If we can be bothered researching that, we might just talk about it.
Yeah.
And poor Melian, I guess, because it's a lot of. And also, I guess, filming Renaissance here at Italy in places that are not Italy.
Yes. In
in Croatia and Wales.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Hello. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, I really like both of those stories.
I've never seen The Mask of Mandragora.
You've never seen it. No. I've only seen it once.
I mean, so I know what happens. That's
I've only seen it once. I'm really, really looking forward to watching it again. Yeah. But that's so interesting. You've never seen it before. It should be a good episode.
Oh my God. New Doctor Who.
And new Tom Baker and the Slain Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Which is surely the best new Doctor Who of all.
Oh, wow. Wow, yeah. I'm looking forward to this. Yeah. This will be great. Thank you for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. Episode 50.
I never thought we'd make it this far.
Yeah. And look at us planning episode 51.
But do you know what? Like, this has been, I mean, this isn't going to get kept in, but this has been, just this whole podcast, I just really enjoyed it. And it's just, I mean, it's always nice to spend time with my friend, obviously, but to just talk about Doctor Who for like a couple of hours and just like, just have a laugh.
Yeah.
It's nice.
Yeah.
And if other people listen to it and enjoy it, then great. That's really good.
I mean, My liver has suffered.
Well, there is that.
Considerably.
We've still got half a bottle of red wine to get through.
like, it's a task. Like, we can't just put the cork back in and leave it.
No, we can't.
Of course we can.
I'm not taking that back home on the train. You fucking kidding me?
You don't have to take it. I'll keep it. It's fine.
You think I'm going to leave wine undrunk in somebody else's house?
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being part of this.
Yes.
As always, every one of these 50 episodes, thank you, however you've encountered them, thank you for being part of this. If you know somebody who may want to join us on this crazy, hurly-burly, drunken trip that we're doing, please recommend them.
Yeah.
We've asked this a couple of times. I think it doesn't really matter. On iTunes, give us a nice write-up.
Yeah.
If not, to be honest, what seems to be developing is that people are communicating with us on Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah,
is far more important.
Oh, it's great to have built up this kind of...
Yeah, like actual people telling us what they think about the episodes, because that really does inform how we talk about it, how we think about these
things.
Yeah,
definitely.
You know?
But thank you so much for listening, all of you who have thus far. We've got no real plans to stop.
I've been Ben.
I've been Mark, and we'll see you in a fortnight's time.
Here's Keith.